top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 367 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, P2, the tied for first with the shortest movie title I've ever seen, the other being Pi, a 90s psychological schizophrenic thriller. P2 sounds like almost a gaming console, but don't let the name sway you. This is actually a very, very capable and very taut, and very tight, and very claustrophobic thriller. And FYI, be forewarned that this is going to have more spoilers than Formula One race. So if you haven't seen the movie, I urge you to check it out, and then check back in for the discussion here. But this is one by Frank Calhoun. He's the director, and if that name sounds familiar, it's almost like Rory Calhoun from the 80s slasher Motel Hell. And of course, the Rory Calhoun, a long-time, old-timey Western actor, but Frank Calhoun, he is responsible for the quite capable, if unspectacular, but I think still warranting your attention, reboot of Maniac, that iconic Bill Lustig 1980s slasher that I think in 1980, yeah, I think many people will have, yours truly included, in their top 10 of the best slashers of all time. And Frank Calhoun is a French director, and he really has a solid understanding of the horror genre based on his work here. Now, his collaborator for P2 is a producer and co-writer, Alexandre Aya. And you'll know that name because of Haute Tension, High Tension, which is a fabulous movie if you haven't had a chance to see it. And I think actually a very spirited animal attack movie that he directed a couple of years back called Crawl, which actually makes a lot of good use of subterranean space in, of all places, Florida, which I didn't know had basements. But I thought it kept the CG to a minimum and actually used it very adroitly and very effectively in a way that I would not have expected, just based on the fact that it's a killer croc movie. Okay, I thought it was very, very good. And Aya actually did very capable and solid work on The Hills Have Eyes, which he did a reboot of, and I think is actually in keeping with the spirit of and the tone of the original. And please disregard The Hills Have Eyes 2, which I believe came out in 2008. Just an absolutely just god-awful piece of dreck. But got to hand it to Aya. He knows his stuff, and Calhoun knows his stuff as well, and having them be collaborators on a project was something that enticed me to see this movie, because when I looked at the thumbnail, I was like, I don't know if I really wanted to do a kind of stalker, creepy guy type movie. I mean, I podcasted Alone, which is about someone who tails this woman throughout the Pacific Northwest and follows her to truck stops, and it's a very, very creepy film and very well done, but I wasn't sure I was quite in the mood for that. And this almost reminded me a little bit of the Misha Barton film called, I think it was called Hoarders, but Misha Barton has made so many just terrible movies, but that one made use of a storage facility, and that is a very, very creepy space to set a horror film. Of course, that film was a complete disaster and I didn't make it through, but I thought when you have a cloistered, compact, tight, claustrophobic space, a la maybe The Descent or films of that ilk, it really makes expert use of it here. And Rachel Nichols is the star, and she plays a woman who's running late at the office, and she runs into car trouble, and she tries to get some assistance from the security guard, and What ends up happening is they have an altercation and he drugs her and she wakes up his prisoner. And this is really sets everything in motion of what's going on in this film. A very, very simple film and something that strikes fear into the hearts of many female listeners here. And I think it'll resonate even particularly so with women having to, I guess, skulk around a dark and abandoned parking garage. And I thought, I mean, these guys really know their stuff for being able to just focus and center a film just around that. Something so simple, something so primitive, something so basic, but something from which there's no escape. Because again, you know, when you set this movie around Christmas, you have a very reasonable security guard actually shuttering the front gate because this is Manhattan and there's lots of homeless people and you're running a car park. It's not some homeless shelter, so they have to be wary of security and be mindful of maybe people, B&Es and people's vehicles, particularly maybe expensive ones in Manhattan and stuff. So I thought that was a really cool thing, and turning the notion of someone who's supposed to provide you with safety and security, as is the name, obviously security guard, I thought was something a really impactful, really cool way to handle this kind of scenario. So she wakes up and they have this very tense meeting as she regains consciousness, and he cites this passage of "The Sun Also Rises" by Hemingway that he finds impactful, and they have this prolonged discussion where he tries to get information from her and asks about her boyfriend, and you have this really terrific dynamic between the two characters. And the security guard is played by Wes Bentley, who you'll know definitely from American Beauty. And he's just dynamite here. So he was Ricky in that film. And he's got, you know, almost a creepy resting face in a way, though he's a kind of a handsome dude, but he's definitely got something a little bit off. And I think this film really plays to its his strengths. And but both of them, I thought Rachel Nichols, she was outstanding as well. And they just have a wonderful dynamic. And of course, it all rests on their dynamic and their interplay. And if that had fallen short, this would have fallen drastically short of the mark too, because this is really a small ensemble piece, but it is fabulous. It is really dynamite. And they go actually a little bit more overboard to, I guess, emphasize the holiday aspect to this by having the security guard's office actually be in the parking garage itself. This would be atypical from my experience of such a thing, but I think they make use of it by having Christmas lights, and the guy has really made it his own space and is really making it like a festive space for the holidays. So he's got Christmas lights all over, almost very garish and all over the place, and his entire office complete with security monitors and closed circuit televisions and all that. Everything is just draped in regalia from the season. I thought that was really kind of cool, even though typically I don't think the office would be in a basement. They would typically have it be in the office tower itself because this guy would do double duty. But I mean, maybe things are different in New York City, but I've never encountered that. Plus, it would be rather unpleasant for a security guard to be in the cold of a parking garage, not to mention being unable to just buzz people in who need to go to and from their offices. That being said, it's a minor quibble, but they have this great interchange where he's pressing her for information about her family, and you get the impression that the Rachel Nichols character, her name is Angela, that's it. You get the impression that she's actually trying to, I guess, lead him astray by just pulling out names. Like, she doesn't seem to want to disclose what her boyfriend slash fiance really does for a living, although I could be wrong with that. She did mention he was a sports writer, and when Thomas, the security guard, goes to pick up his, I guess, New York Post, she says, no, he's an online journalist, and you wouldn't see his byline in print. So I get the impression that she was maybe making something up. So she is definitely no shrinking violet, and she's nobody's victim, and actually trying to, as best she can, play mind games with Thomas and actually referring to him by name. And he actually points this out later, saying, you're just just trying to humanize yourself so I don't kill you, that kind of thing. And not in those exact words, but something a little more subtle and more deft. But what it turns out happens is that he has orchestrated a plot, a kidnapping plot that's not based on bringing Angela harm, actually, which is one of the big plot points and one of the big twists in the film. And it's something that no one, I defy anyone to see coming. It is a sensational twist, and it happens in Act 1, which is fantastic, because a lot of these things, particularly in the horror space, will happen in the third act and will have no coherent build-up to justify their existence in many ways. And you'll say that just made total, it was just totally nonsensical, kind of like the nude Loomis from Halloween 2018, just off the top of my head. But in this one, it's actually a kidnapping plot by a well-meaning Thomas who's like trying to white knight this woman. And he's basically trying to show himself, reveal himself to be an ally of her. And let me explain. He, of course, has security. He does security detail for this high-rise office tower with a bunch of law firms and whatnot in it. And he is privy to having all this surveillance info on people. And what he managed to capture and what spurred his motivation for this kidnapping plot was a drunken pass that one of Angela's co-workers made on her in an elevator. So what his design is and what his MO is to bring Angela to her assailant and have her mete out justice. And this I did not see coming. And I thought, wow, what a position to put her in as judge, jury, and executioner, potentially, for someone who was assaulting her in an elevator. Now, this could have gone several ways. Turns out, based on the restraint that I think Aya shows and that Calhoun shows, they actually make it an ambiguous scenario. Yes, the guy made a pass at her on the elevator, but it was in the throes of drunkenness. And while this wouldn't, of course, not excuse such piggish behavior, it still does not make him a rapist or some Me Too type guy, as Angela herself explained, saying they're actually friends. And this was a moment of where he'd let the drink get the better of him and actually just, you know, made a wrong move. And she had forgiven him, and she is very reluctant to do Thomas's bidding. And the way they're introduced to this guy, I mean, I did not see this coming. So the character who'd made this unwanted pass at her is tied to an office chair. He's duct taped to, I believe, in the P3 level of this parking garage. And he is, of course, just struggling to get loose. And they come upon him in Thomas's vehicle. So he drives Angela down there and says, you know, I have a surprise for you. And this is something I did not see coming. And it introduces a different moral dilemma and a moral and ethical concern that puts this above and beyond your typical slasher film. Because they could have done the standard issue stalk and slash torment kind of film. And that's where I thought this was going. But no, Angela's put in this position that's really unenviable, where she's given, I believe, a really heavy duty flashlight, one of those like 3-pound heavy, solid heavy-duty flashlights that you'd take maybe camping or something. And she's implored and she's cajoled into maybe beating this guy about the head. And she wants no part of it. And of course, at every second, she's trying to make her getaway. And I thought, man, that was a really interesting scenario and something that was, again, makes this a cut above. Now, also what happens to this man is beyond the pale, and it's something that actually the New York Times pointed out that in their dismissive critique of this film, although I think they lauded it overall, they said it was too exploitative. But I didn't find that to be the case at all. But when this guy meets his maker, it's not at the hands of Angela, but rather part of this protracted vehicular homicide scene that is almost funny and cringeworthy, but also terrifying at the same time. Because the Thomas in his vehicle is pushing this guy in his office chair, and he's rolling along the concrete, and he just runs him right into the nearest wall, and it's just unbelievable how that's handled. And it's really, really impactful, really solid, really well done. And with him out of the picture, it becomes more of your more conventional, I guess, type of, cat and mouse game where you have the Angela character freeing herself and you think she's going to get the better of her antagonist, but then maybe not. And then it does degenerate somewhat into your standard film where of this ilk where the first responders, the police, arrive on the scene but prove ineffectual. But that, I think, actually adds to the tension because they are actually invited into the premises and they unfortunately cannot be of any assistance. And the Frank Calhoun leads you to believe that this killer is actually going to off the two police as well. But it turns out they're just doing their rounds. He's actually very inviting, lets them go through. It says, FYI, there's a water main leak on one of the levels. You're going to have to keep an eye out for that. And they say their farewells. And New York's finest go out into the dark night. Yeah, there's also different ways that Angela interfaces with the public as well. So she's at this point hidden under a vehicle and can't. The timing doesn't work out so that she's not able to call the police officers for help. There's also a very impactful scene with a hobo going by, like a bag lady. And Angela calls out through one of the locked gates for help, and the homeless lady actually just repeats what she says. And I thought that was really, really impactful. So obviously the homeless lady was unhinged and just repeating what she heard. And I thought that was amazing. Like, of all the people to encounter, it would be someone who can't provide you any assistance whatsoever. And I thought just the raw, foreboding atmosphere was just ratcheted up, particularly with an elevator scare. And I bring up The Descent earlier as a movie that takes makes incredible use of spelunking, although I didn't care for the denouement particularly, but it makes really good use of the tight spaces and claustrophobia inherent in spelunking and cave exploring. And I thought, like, they brilliantly used an elevator, because at one point, I guess Angela breaks free from her captor and decides to hide in one of these elevators and just keeps pressing buttons to prevent the security guard from accessing her. But he has a fire hose and lowers it down and tries to drown her inside the elevator. And it's just things like this, the tightness, the close-knit, claustrophobic nature of this film that I think really makes it very impactful. Now, we want to segue into things I learned. You do have this, again, amazing dynamic with very few characters, and I think other movies can learn from this in the horror space, where if you have the right kind of atmosphere, you don't really need to have too many characters. Like, you can have a self-contained unit of horror. I'm thinking of another movie called The Invitation, which involves a dinner party that goes horribly awry, and it's kind of turns into a home invasion type thriller, but you have a few characters in whom you can wholly invest, and don't introduce like 20 or 30 of them. Get 3 or 4, 5 tops and just situate them in a place that has like a really good horrific impact. And again, with women being alone in a parking garage, it really is wrought with horror and fraught with anxiety and tension, haute tension. Really, you have this amazing set piece that you can do wonders with in the hands of someone who's talented, and I would say that Alexandra Aya and Frank Calhoun definitely are. Another thing I've learned is that there's an incredible Rottweiler here. Not only does this security guard have this elaborate office with all the surveillance equipment, but he actually has a big, big, bullish and drooling Rottweiler. It's very intimidating, and he uses it to his advantage when he's intimidating his captive. And it's really, really well done. And when Angela at one point has to break the glass of a parked car and defend herself against this Cujo type beast, it's one for the ages, because I've always said when an animal gets harmed in a film, you know that you're dealing with something that's knows how to push your buttons and know how to push boundaries. And I did not see that coming. The way Angela acquits herself, she's a very strong, very resourceful, very tough character. There's a very, very impactful scene where Thomas gets her to phone home and tries to just get her to say, listen, I'm going to be late, I'm not feeling well, I have the flu. And the kind of snorting nostrils and the tearing and the anxiety that Rachel Nichols brings to the Angela Bridges character is so good and so well done. And this movie is so small and so quiet and very low budget, although it looks looks more expensive than it is. Just a couple million bucks, I think, on the budget, but it has a kind of a slick look that it makes incredible use of the space. Again, not only is the parking garage space made an incredible spot to have your the scene for your horror film, but also the Frank Calfoun actually dims the lights at one point, or he has his character do that, so you make it even darker and even more sinister and even more creepy. The only experience I really have driving around in a car park is maybe my mom's condo, and after hours when all you can hear maybe as you're turning and making the loop down into the underground, into the subterranean mass, is maybe the squeaking of your wheels and your steering wheel. And it's kind of a strange scene, and I gotta admit, if I've arrived home late and I'm up visiting my mom, then it's something that can have an impact on you, even if you're a man, right? Because I think it's actually the dangers posed by an actual car park are actually fairly minimal compared to just being outside. And I think somewhere that doesn't have that much foot traffic, I think that's a little more accessible. I think if the gates are shut, it's really safe. But the thing is, many of the gates are not shut, particularly in Toronto with these kinds of parking garages. But I think that's changing of late. Another thing I learned is that this one, I mean, did not do too great at the box office. And it's a bit of a shame, too, because I think it's something that should have been, like, it should actually be in the conversations of among the better Christmas horror films ever, I would say. And that's faint praise, because there's not that many of them, let's be honest. But my top five off the top of my head would be Profondo Rosso, Deep Red, Dario Argento, L'Intérieur, Inside, the French New Wave horror film, Rabid, the David Cronenberg film, my personal favorite, I think if I had to pick one, probably Christmas Evil, John Waters' actually favorite film too, of that ilk, and Black Christmas, of course, the Bob Clark film. But if you're looking at, let's say, entries 6 through, let's say, 12 or 13, you could easily put P2 in there, I think, very, very capably. The score, I think the filmmaker said they wanted to make very Bernard Herrmann-like, so you have kind of a neat score, but also some kind of a kitschy, fun scene where you have the antagonist dancing and mimicking and miming Blue Christmas, the Elvis Presley hit. And he of course, that's like a late 40s song that Elvis, I think, brought to prominence in the 60s, but it's like a staple of Christmas movies. And just the spin he put on it and the enjoyment the antagonist derives from lip syncing the song, I thought was funny and actually quite endearing in a way. And it puts you in another place and has a very, very adds a very, let's say, unique vibe to the proceedings, and I thought it was really dynamite. It's also amplified by this very kitschy, kind of tacky Elvis, like this dancing Elvis statue, or statuette, I guess you could say. It's pretty funny. Like, I actually have a penguin that is a penguin Elvis that when you press its foot actually dances and jingles to Jailhouse Rock, and I wish I could find that thing. It's just unbelievably kitschy and bad and tacky and ugly and everything, but I just thought that was very, very well handled. I thought it was really interesting. So yeah, this could have done, I believe it would have, if it did a worldwide gross of $8 million and the budget was $2.5-3 million, at least they probably would have broken even with the film accounting as it is, right? I mean, movie accounting is incredibly difficult to tabulate. This is a 2007 film, so there may be still chance to have this one get some extra life or get a second life on, maybe through Blu-ray or some other streaming services or something. So Roger Ebert gave this film 3 out of 4, and he said it was a very well-made atmospheric thriller with gritty yet realistic characters, and I couldn't agree more. And in an era where you have, I mean, that kill accepted, or I told you about the vehicular homicide and just the intense gore of that one. I thought it was really kind of neat that as a means to escape her captor, Angela grabs a fork and shoves it into his shoulder, into Thomas's shoulder, and he bleeds a little bit, and you can tell this is not a mortal wound, because it really bugs me in films where you have someone who maybe gets crucified or something, or gets some sort of awful injury, and then they keep going on based on God knows what, some sort of adrenaline rush, and it seems overly fake and unrealistic. But to have her use what it's available at her disposal to try and thwart her attacker and forge an escape, I thought was really amazing. Because Thomas tries to sit down with her and have a Christmas dinner that consists of some offerings that he brought from some local grocery store that he was going to heat up in the microwave. So he sets up this whole Christmas dinner with the two of them. And obviously he has romantic interests in her. And he actually, after he chloroforms her, you don't see it, but he puts her in this dress and puts lipstick on her and takes video of her. And that's one of the more impactful aspects later. Another thing I learned is she finds out that he had been taking video of her, and there's a particularly very creepy scene where he's seen administering lipstick on her when she's passed out. And I thought, man, that was something that wouldn't be out of place in Maniac. And I mean the first Maniac, and maybe even Calhoun's remake. It's been a while since I've seen that one, but I just thought it was a very creepy, very intimate, and very strong horror effort here. And this is a guy who knows what he's doing behind the camera, a team that really knows what they're doing. They know what scares are. They know when to ratchet up the gore and when not to. The denouement, I thought, might have been a little silly, but I think the payoff isn't one that is going to you can't find too much fault with it. So I thought it was really, really quite well done on a whole. I'm going to give this 4 out of 5, especially if you put it in the context of a Christmas horror, and a lot of Christmas horrors maybe aren't that great. I've never been too big on Santa's Sleigh or Better Watch Out, I thought was kind of good, but still nothing spectacular. Sint has its moments. There are these types of films that are kind of okay, but I think you could easily put this one in your top 10. I thought it was really, really compellingly acted. It was very solid. It was very contained, very quiet, and loud when it needed to be. So kudos. And yeah, I'm always looking forward to seeing more from these gentlemen, these two Parisians here, because they really know their stuff, and it's nice to see someone respect the horror genre and really know what makes it tick and gets pulses racing. Anyway, hope you had a great holiday, and don't forget to pick up a copy of Death by Umbrella, 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, and if you're a fan of action movies, check out Mine's Bigger Than Yours, 100 Wackiest Action Movies. Those are the two books Jeff and I co-authored, still available in bookstores and online around the world. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.